Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, March 8th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Steve.
And also with us in the studio is WCAI lead reporter Sarah Mises-Tan. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
And a little later in the program, we'll hear from Landry Harlan at the Vineyard Gazette. And we'll speak with Tim Wood, the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Now, a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the islands. The big story this week is Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station in Plymouth. The plant has been in the lowest performing category for years. This week, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission said it's improved enough that it is now in the top category. Sarah, explain what happened here.
Sure. So the Nuclear Regulatory Commission announced that it was changing Pilgrim's rating from a column 4 to column 1. This basically meant that the plant went from being categorized as you said, one of the worst performing power plants in the country to back in the category where regularly functioning power plants are. That's about 90 or so power plants across the country. The plant had been in category 4 since 2015 when the commission discovered numerous safety concerns and problems in the safety culture at the plant. They created a list of about 150 safety violations that they asked Entergy to fix, and they now say the company has addressed all of them. This isn't totally out of the blue. I just wanted to note, for months now, we've been watching as Entergy and the NRC said items on this checklist had been completed and marked as no longer a concern.
Patrick, a lot to unpack here, but one of the things that strikes me is that there's such a history of safety violations and safety mismanagement around this that we heard a lot of people expressing skepticism when this came out.
Absolutely, and skepticism about the leap from column 4 to column 1, but also about the timing of it. It comes as they're looking at basically shutting down the plant in June. So a lot of people questioned whether or not they were doing this just so they could look good at the end. This is coming, as some people say, really at an odd time, as they're still having problems that have existed for the last couple of years.
And there's one in the article the Cape Cod Times has here. You point out that no plant has ever been closed while it was in column 4 in the history of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So there was some sense that maybe the Nuclear Regulatory System Commission didn't want to see this plant close in column 4, I guess is what some of the folks were pointing to.
Yes, and the fact is that there have only been 9 plants that have ended up in this column, and as you said, none of them have closed there. So people look at this, they look at the regulators, and they say, "What are they doing this just so that these plants can end up looking good at the end of their life?"
Sarah, the leap from column 4 to column 1, it turns out this is not unusual.
The NRC has said this is pretty typical. Plants can move from column 1 through to column 4, so 1, 2, 3, 4, as they degrade and continue to violate safety requirements. But it's never happened before that a plant has been downgraded to a column 2 or column 3. They always move from column 4 back to column 1.
It's never been upgraded from column 4
to
3 or 2. Right. It always leaps from column 4 to column 1. Now, Entergy, Patrick, tell us what Entergy said about all of this.
Well, Entergy says they've been working really hard at dealing with these problems. They point to that question of culture and say that they've fixed a lot of the things that have been raised. They had a long list that they had to deal with. I think it was 156 at one point deficiencies that were identified in what's called a confirmatory action letter that was issued in 2017. In January, the NRC reported that the plant operators had closed out the final 40 items on that list. And so in their statements to us, they said that they had really been doing this is the plant's operator, of course, doing a good job of addressing all these issues. NRC, on their part, says that the amount of oversight that exists at the plant has been above and beyond, as you would expect when you're in that worst performing category. Neil Sheehan, who's a spokesman for the NRC, says that normally if you're in column 1, you have about 5,700 hours of inspections to complete. At Pilgrim in 2018, there were 11,300 hours of inspection-related activities that were completed. So they say they've been watching closely. Obviously, activists who are not in favor of the plant operating and concerned about safety say this is essentially a whitewash, is what they're calling it.
Being in column four, which is the worst performing, or column one, the difference here really is the number of inspection hours.
Yeah. Pilgrim, I guess, as Patrick said, 11,300 hours of inspections back in 2018. And this comprised of inspections by on-site inspectors and also special teams that came in quarterly to look at specific safety and security protocols. And then, of course, they are going to move back to the baseline, which is 5,600 hours per year. I don't know what that's going to break down with for Pilgrim.
Even just doing the math here, there's about 8,700 hours in a year. So you can get a sense that 11,300 is, you know, I'm sure they're sort of breaking this out across groups of people, but still, it's more than 24-hour surveillance, you would think, in a year.
Yeah,
that way, or oversight, I should say.
Yeah, and now they're going to, I guess they're going to lose the special teams that come on site, and they say they're just going to have, I guess, two inspectors that are on site that are going to be doing regular checkups.
And all of this comes, as Patrick was pointing it out, as the plant is moving towards a shutdown at the end of May. June 1st is the date when that's expected to happen. So there will be plenty of attention on this plant going forward.
Definitely, yeah.
Patrick, interesting story out this week. The Wall Street Journal reporting that a number of major research institutions have been targeted in Chinese cyber attacks. And this lands close to home, possibly, as the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution is believed to be among them.
Yes, and these attacks were focused on, it seemed, maritime technology and military applications. There were at least 27 universities, again, this is according to some reporting in the Wall Street Journal, that were targeted by these Chinese hackers. And the majority of them have research centers focused on undersea technology, along with connections to the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. The report itself had not come out when the Wall Street Journal was reporting on it officially, and a Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution spokeswoman who our reporter Christine Legere talked to was quick to point out that that isn't the case. They didn't have anything to kind of refute in some ways because the report wasn't available, and she called it speculation, saying that they have not seen anything that indicated that Woods Hole, the HUI, was affected by these attacks, even though the report said it was likely that that organization was also breached. This isn't the first time that HUI's had to deal with this. Back in 2015, they became aware of a cyber attack. They hired a firm to deal with cybersecurity. They say they've really buttoned up their security systems, and they've dealt with it, and they don't think anything has really happened since then. But as somebody who I was talking to the other day said, basically, there are two categories of organizations, the ones who know they've been the target of a cyber attack and the ones that don't know they've been the target of a cyber attack but have. Again, it seems HUI may fall into both these categories, or it may be that the report was getting ahead of itself. Certainly, it's not the first time that CAPE organizations have dealt with this type of thing. In 2014, the Massachusetts Maritime Academy's website was hacked, and just recently, in November, Cape Cod Community College lost $800,000 from their coffers during a cyber attack. They said they were confident they were going to get that money back. But again, with HUI, their close ties to the Navy, their close ties to R&D and kind of universities that do that work really seemed to make them a potential target, certainly in the past. And it's unclear at this point whether they were breached at this latest attack.
We're going to speak right now with Landry Harlan at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Landry.
Good morning.
Landry, a town hall meeting on the island with state representatives this week was well attended. Tell us who was there and what the representatives heard from constituents.
Yes, so the new legislative session has started on Beacon Hill, and that means our legislators, Dylan Fernandez and Julian Sear, have a whole host of bills they want to see passed this session, and they came to talk about them this week. And the bills cover a lot of issues important to the Cape and Islands, affordable housing, the environment. But really, there was one issue that really came up the most, and it was the Steamship Authority. Listeners probably know that the last year for the steamship has been a bit of a rough one. There was a series of cancellations and delays that started last year, last March. And a recent report has said that the whole organization needs a bit of a management and communications overhaul. and residents were echoing that at this meeting. They were even urging Mr. Fernandez and Mr. Sear to look at the Enabling Act of the SSA because they believe that the service is acting more in the service of making money and not serving year-round islanders. And it's really it's interesting. The following evening, actually, there was an actual Steamship Authority meeting on the island, but it was sparsely attended, even though it was a public forum for people to air their concerns. So it's interesting that some residents feel they have they might be better heard from state legislators than the actual organization.
And did the legislatures have anything to say about the residents' concern about the Steamship Authority?
They did. So they were quick to say that they really don't have much authority over the independent organization that doesn't even take money from the state. And they prefer to wait on if the organization really takes this recent consultant report to heart and makes some big changes before they consider anything else. They told the concerned residents that perhaps we can write a letter or urge the organization to look into their mission, but really we have no power over changing it ourselves.
And how about the other issues that they heard about? Did they have any feedback on affordable housing or some of these other issues?
Sure. Well, it's interesting. Those issues didn't really come up much. There was a wide range, but really the other main one that came up that's important to island residents is a ban on mopeds in the town of Oak Bluffs. And again, Mr. Fernandez and Mr. Sears said that they filed a home rule petition and it didn't have luck the first time they tried refiling it, but really they mentioned that 8,000 bills are filed each year and only 8% make it. So it's going to be a long uphill battle for that to get passed. But they said on the wide range of bills they're focused on, they're really excited to work hard for the islanders, and especially on the issues of affordable housing and the environment.
Landry Harlan at the Vineyard Gazette. Landry, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. And welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy, and on the phone with us right now is Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning.
Tim, the buyer for the Monomoy Theater has revealed himself. We talked about this previously. The theater's up for sale, and there are a number of concerns about what it could mean for the historic property. So tell us, what do we know?
Well, as you say, the mystery was cleared up Monday when Greg Clark of Alexandra Properties in Newton announced at the selectmen's meeting that his company had an agreement to purchase the theater property. He made some brief remarks. Clark is a Weston resident, but he has a home here in Chatham, and he said the property, the company plans to renovate the buildings on the property and then place them on the National Register of Historic Places. Now, this, as we talked about before, the Steinler family, which has owned the theater since the property since the 1950s, decided to sell late last year after the University of Hartford, which has held the lease on the property for the past few years, and has sponsored the college program that brings in students to put on productions every summer. The university had declined to renew its lease. After town inspectors found various health and safety violations in the dorm rooms on the property, and there was sort of a bit of a dispute about who was responsible for correcting those problems. Now, theater officials and supporters feared that this pending sale would mean the end of the long-running program. At this point, we don't know what's going to happen still. Mr. Clark was a bit vague about the long-term plans for the property. He did say that he had heard the concerns about the theater not continuing, and he said he plans to meet with theater officials. In fact, they're meeting today to talk about perhaps having some sort of a season there this summer. Meanwhile, his long-range plans, as I said, are uncertain. He has told us that basically He will be reaching out to the historical commission to talk about the buildings on the property, and he said it's sort of too early in the process to announce any plans publicly. He said the company is still doing its due diligence, and they will announce their plans once they've completed the sale and have plans to file with the town. The closing on the property is scheduled for April 30th. The university's lease runs out at the end of March, so we're coming up on a couple weeks here where sort of the next summer's situation with this property is going to be determined. So we'll be keeping an eye on that very closely.
Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for the update.
Thank you, Steve.
Patrick Cassidy is with me from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, the attorney for the accused killer of Yarmouth Police Sergeant Sean Gannon, is requesting records from all Cape Cod police departments. And these are records about police behavior in the aftermath of the shooting.
Yes, and obviously this is a case that got a lot of attention at the time. Sean Gannon, as you mentioned, was killed April 12th. Thomas Latanowicz, 30, has been accused in that killing. And now this case is moving forward through the courts. Joseph Krawski Jr., who's Latanowicz's attorney, made a pitch this week to get documents not only from Yarmouth Police Department about Gannon's personnel record and information about his dog Nero, who was also shot. The dog did survive. But also about the number of other officers who showed up for different arraignments in this case. And he wanted to find out whether there was a concerted effort on these officers' part to, as he said, taint the jury pool. And this is all an effort to essentially get this trial moved to another county. So he's going forward with that. And he's also asking for us, the Cape Cod Times, and one of our sister publications, the Barnstable Patriot, to provide stories and other information that we published, photographs, etc. I mean, it is all available online, and not to make too fine a point about this, but it's not as if we're hiding things that we've published, but he is saying that we would somehow have better access to all of that information that's been published than he would, and so he's asking for that as well. And again, this is all to paint a picture of the amount of attention that this case got and his concern that a jury could not come in and objectively decide guilt or innocence, or I'm not exactly sure what his defense is. So we'll see how that plays out. There's going to be a hearing. There's basically been notices sent to all these agencies and apparently coming to us for this information. But again, this attorney is really arguing that police departments may have decided that they were going to show up with this show of force. It really, to the police, was a show of support for their fallen comrade. But in doing so, were they doing it on purpose in order to taint the jury pool?
Let's speak right now with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, the town had been looking at buying an island hotel to turn into affordable housing. That idea now seems to be off the table.
It is definitely off the table, at least for now. You're right. The town had been looking into buying the Nantucket Inn property, about a 100-room hotel across from Nantucket Memorial Airport, to convert into affordable housing units for about $27 million. But the majority owner of the property failed to meet several deadlines regarding the town's due diligence on the property and didn't sign the $27 million offer to purchase by March 1st, town officials said. And as a result, they've asked the Finance Committee to recommend that voters take no action on spending that money at next month's town meeting. And the committee unanimously approved that request. Town housing officials said that they really weren't in the position to spend potentially tens of thousands of dollars on due diligence if they didn't even know the property would be available if and when the voters approved that kind of money. So they decided to put it off at least for now. There had been some discussions as well about converting the property's main building into a new and expanded senior center. The town's existing senior center downtown is on the small side and not up to accommodating the town's growing elderly population. So they're also going back to the drawing board to look at different scenarios for a new senior center. It doesn't mean the deal is completely dead, town officials said. If the property is still available down the road, if they can get a offer to purchase signed, then they could potentially explore it at an upcoming special town meeting or next year's town meeting if it's still around. There are a couple of private buyers also interested both the seller's representative, real estate agent, and town officials have said. So that's up in the air a little bit too, though.
Another story, the island's middle school principal will be leaving. He had applied for the open superintendent position.
He had, and when he was not recommended as a finalist to the school committee, he decided to step down from the middle school principal position when his contract expires in June and seek other educational leadership opportunities off the island. Peter Cohen, who has been the middle school principal for nearly a decade now, said that he has his superintendent and assistant superintendent licenses in the state of Massachusetts, and when he was passed over for the superintendent's position, or at least as a finalist, he decided that it's time to seek other opportunities elsewhere. He said he's enjoyed his time on Nantucket in the Nantucket school system, but in the interest of his career, it's time to move on. School officials, school administrators also said they'll be sorry to see him go, but now they have two positions to fill, potentially a middle school principal position and the school superintendent position, and they're also a little bit of an impasse there. The choice of three of the school committee members, the finalists, stepped down or backed out of the search right before they were about to vote on narrowing the down further. So they're still meeting to discuss potential candidates for the superintendent's position and what might happen in that as well. Superintendent Michael Kozort had announced that he was going to be retiring at the end of this school year, but that may be up in the air a little bit now, too.
Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, another police story. Falmouth police are joining some other police departments in setting up a database of private citizens who have home surveillance systems. Explain this for us.
This is what they're calling a electronic neighborhood watch, if you will. The department has put out a call for property owners to provide them with information about their private surveillance systems, or basically register these locations with police. And the idea, police say in Falmouth, is that when they go out to reported crime, they're often looking for this type of surveillance footage to find out what happened, or maybe it could be even when they're looking for a missing person, seeing if that person has wandered by the neighborhood. And this would just make it faster because they would know where these cameras are. They could get in touch with people who they think may have some sort of surveillance in the area of wherever the crime has been committed, and they would be able to get that information faster, act faster. They are quick to point out, obviously some people would have privacy concerns with this, that they wouldn't have direct access to the feed or to the video without first coming again and asking the homeowner or the property owner for that video. This is just so that they kind of have mapped out where all these cameras are. It is done in other places. There are a number of towns in southeastern Massachusetts, for example, that already have this system in place. And there have already been some people who have taken the Falmouth Police up on this offer and provided information about their systems. Executive Director of the Massachusetts Chiefs of Police Association, Mark Leahy, says it's a time saver. And the first thing that came to mind for him, again, was the case of a missing child or a senior citizen where time may be of the essence. So we'll see how many people register their systems with the Falmouth Police.
And again, kind of stressing here that they're not going to connect their systems to any kind of government database or anything. It's a registry, as you say, of where these systems are in the community.
Yes, and again, that seems to be something that would alleviate some people's concerns. Obviously, there may be other people who would still have concerns about providing that amount of information to police. You could see, I suppose, that if they knew you had the camera and they wanted what was in the camera one way or the other about whatever case they're investigating, that they may then come to you and, subpoena that information or try and get that information one way or the other. But again, people can volunteer this information and then they might be able to use it to solve a crime or help find somebody.
Ed Miller is joining us right now at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning.
Ed, you have an investigative piece about a local company that offers home and business cleaning, which is being accused by its employees of failing to pay them and a number of other issues. Tell us about this company and what's happening here.
Sure. The company is called Spotless New England, and it operates out of both Boston and Provincetown and offers home and business cleaning and concierge services for rental properties. And the employees of this business, at least out here on the Outer Cape, are entirely Bulgarian workers who come to province town every summer, most of them holding J-1 visas, which are for exchange visitor. They're mainly students who come for a few months in the summer. The number of students coming here from Bulgaria is really remarkable. It's estimated at around 500 or more each year. And they hold all kinds of jobs here.
They're coming to the Provincetown area. 500,
that's right, yeah.
500 or more, yes.
Yeah, from Bulgaria. Other countries as well, but especially Bulgaria. So Spotless New England had a crew last summer of approximately 40 workers, according to the owner of the business, Nick Dennis. The banner conducted an investigation after receiving a tip about one worker in particular who had gone to the police to complain that he hadn't been paid. And the Provincetown police told him that it was a civil issue, and so they wouldn't do anything about it. He should pursue it in the courts, which he has done. He has now filed suit against Spotless New England. But our investigation, which went for almost 2 months, and at least five summer workers, all from Bulgaria, who said that either the company owes them money or that they had extraordinary difficulty getting paid. The issue is that he seemed to have not a traditional way of keeping records. The suit that has been filed, first of all, says that the workers were misclassified, or this particular worker, whose name is Ilyan Stefanov, was misclassified as an independent contractor when he should have been a regular employee. And then non-payment of wages, non-payment of travel expenses, and failure to maintain proper payroll records. And we talked to a number of, or heard by email from a number of workers who had very similar stories. And we also talked to Mr. Dennis, who denied that he owes any of these people money, and refused to answer any specific questions about his employment practices, but just sent one email earlier this week that said, "I deny all wrongdoing." It's clear from speaking to lawyers that these foreign workers are easy targets for unscrupulous employers, and this is certainly not a common practice. I mean, the people I spoke with from Bulgaria said that in general they're treated very well and paid properly. Of course, these workers all are subject to income and payroll taxes like everyone else, but often they're not aware of their legal rights as employees in Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And so if there, you know, the current climate of immigration law enforcement creates a lot of fear in these worker communities. So many of them are really afraid to step forward and complain when they're not treated properly. But they need to know that they do have rights. There is such a thing, for example, as a U visa that protects anyone from immigration and law enforcement if they are a witness to or a victim of a crime.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in wage employment law cases, there are lawyers who will take the case with no upfront payment, because the law provides that if in fact there has been a violation, the employer is responsible for paying the attorney's fees.
This is a great story, and there's a lot here, Ed. I'm going to encourage folks to look at it at the website Wicked Local Provincetown, or pick up a copy of the banner. And you guys did, as you say, a two-month investigation. It's a really a deep story with a lot there.
Thanks so much, Steve. It's great to be able to let people know about this important thing that's happening.
Thank you, Ed. With me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Patrick, the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe is no longer receiving money to support its tribal operations from the company that has been working with it to get a casino.
Yeah, obviously we've been following this effort by the tribe to open a casino in Taunton. It's experienced a number of setbacks over the past year, and some of those setbacks, it seems to have led to Genting Malaysia, which is the company that's been backing this billion-dollar project, basically not going forward with supporting the tribe's government operations, which it has been doing. Genting has essentially sunk $440 million or more at this point into this project through loans to the tribe. A lot of this has gone to legal fees. They've been fighting a challenge by neighbors in Taunton who have successfully really blocked the tribe's efforts to move forward with this casino. And a lot of it has gone to lobbying. There's ongoing legislation that the tribe is hoping will essentially clear the way for that casino project and for them to continue to hold their land in trust, which is the kind of the underlying basis for that casino project being able to go forward. But some of that money has gone towards the tribe, about $12 million, I think, a year is what the tribe's chairman, Cedric Cromwell, told us at one point, which is the operating budget for the tribe. A lot of that, if not all of it, has come from Genting, and now Genting is saying, according to sources on the tribal council who we've spoken to, they are saying that that money is not going to continue to flow at this point, and the future operations and the funding for those future operations is uncertain. It's obviously an uncertain time for the tribe all around, and they've seen that funding drop off from Genting over the last year or so, probably in reaction to some of these setbacks.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And on the phone with us right now from the Martha's Vineyard Times is George Brennan. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. George, some months back, we talked about the Martha's Vineyard Playhouse being notified that it would have to pay property taxes, and it had formerly been exempt from those. Now the theater has had a chance to make its case that it should continue to be exempt. Tell us about this.
Yeah, they went before the Board of Assessors. It was technically it was an abatement hearing. They've paid their first quarter taxes and filed for an abatement. And so they got an opportunity to come in. They were actually scheduled for 15 minutes, but it took about 45 minutes. That's how much backup they had for why they deserve a tax exemption. Some of the things that they do in the community, the educational programs they provide for kids, you know, some of the theater programs that are given at a reduced rate. You know, for example, veterans get as many as 4 tickets a year for free. Other people are also, you know, lower income people. People who have EBT cards are also given discounted tickets or free tickets, you know, just to give them a taste of the cultural offerings that the Martha's Vineyard Playhouse does have to offer. And so, you know, the assessors took it all in. They tried to explain again why they had made the decision to revoke the exemption, saying that they hadn't gotten enough information. This really, if you remember, created a firestorm in the community. People were just stunned that this would happen to Martha's Vineyard Playhouse. It's, you know, considered a beacon here on in Vineyard Haven of culture. So many different offerings. They bring in actors from around the country in the summertime to provide some really, really good shows. So anyway, there was no decision at the end of this hearing. The assessors say they have up to 2 more months to make a decision, 3 months from the date that the abatement was filed. And so we should be hearing sometime in the next 2 months, maybe sooner, because, you know, honestly, by the end, the 2 assessors who were there seemed to be leaning toward, you know, giving them back their exemption.
Mm. Another story you have, a property listing appeared briefly that caught the eye of a Times reporter, and it's kind of an unusual story here. This listing was only there briefly on the website. Tell us about this property and what you were able to learn about what happened.
Yes, yeah, so this is a site near the airport. The airport owns the property. It's a business park, and it was Airport Fitness at 24 Airport Road. They put the listing up on their this listing was put up, and we called all kinds of people, and they had no idea, what we were talking about. They said, people from the airport had not heard about this. People from the county, and this is a county-owned airport,
this
they
was
didn't know.
Offering the property as a potential hotel site, right?
That's right, for $2.975 million, so close to $3 million. And it said the property, but when you read the fine print, it's really the lease that they're offering because they don't own the property. Interestingly, we have a new development just this morning. We got a letter from Connie McHugh, who's the owner of Airport Fitness, and she acknowledges that they were, in fact, the people looking to add this hotel to their site, but they didn't. They pulled it down. So it's interesting because she initially told us that she didn't know about it, and she seemed surprised that we were asking about it as well. But today she's telling us that, yeah, she did in fact know about it, but it's, they're not looking right now for a hotel site.
George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Steve. Have a good weekend.
Patrick Cassidy is with me from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, in Hyannis, there's talk of relocating a proposed performing arts center, and if it gets built, this could be a big new addition to the downtown.
Yeah, I feel like we've been reporting about a new performing arts center in the Hyannis area for a decade, probably twice that amount, really. But this is what's being called the Oceanside Performing Arts Center. It's something that was proposed as a new home for the Cape Symphony and for obviously other events. It was originally proposed for a location behind the Hyannis Resort and Conference Center, which is kind of on the west side of Hyannis, where the Twin Brooks Golf Course is currently. But we obtained essentially a document that laid out a plan to potentially, and again, it's not sure where this is going to be in the end, move it closer to our offices here on the other side of town and at the Cape Cod Maritime Museum property and kind of part of Michael Asselton Park, which is right on the harbor. So Oceanside, obviously, is the name. This would put them really a little closer to the actual water. But it is a plan that's still very much in motion. We reached out to a lot of people. Our reporter Jason Savio reached out to a lot of people who didn't respond. But those who did said that they thought it was going to be potentially a good idea and kind of a boon for downtown. The president of Oceanside, Gerald Garnick, did talk to us, and he said, this is one location that they're looking at. They do still have a binding contract with the Twin Brooks Golf Course location, and that's still absolutely in consideration. And he also hinted at the fact or said that there are other locations that are being considered. He declined to mention those. But this would be a 1,400-seat performing arts center, and it would also potentially connect to where they want to or are proposing to move the Maritime Museum, which is to the old National Guard Armory, which is down on South Street here. So a lot of dominoes, a lot of things would have to move around a little bit, but folks are looking at it and saying that this is potentially a good idea. Elizabeth Warfane, who's with the Hyannis Main Street Business Improvement District, said it makes the most sense. And she kind of looked at Boston as a location that you could cite as an example, where it's kind of the waterfront area has really become much more vibrant in recent years, and kind of doing that down here in Hyannis. But again, a lot of things would have to happen for this to move forward. And it may be that it's somewhere else in the end.
We have been following the turmoil between the towns of Dennis and Yarmouth over their shared school district. There's been disagreement about how that system is funded. It's a disagreement that's threatening the construction of a new middle school. Now the school committee itself has been working to come up with some proposals to improve the cost sharing between the two towns.
Certainly another story and debate that we've been following for years here. Most recently, the Dennis Yarmouth Regional School District as a whole approved the building of a $117 million middle school in a December 4th vote. It was decided by very few number of votes, 25 in the end. And folks in Yarmouth voted largely against it. Folks in Dennis voted largely for it, or the majority in each town voted for or against it. But that did set off a potential lawsuit, or a lawsuit that has been filed by Yarmouth against the school district and against the town of Dennis, which they named in their lawsuit. And essentially they were saying that the district-wide vote was not the way it was supposed to be done, that it should have gone to each of the town meetings to be decided. And that, again, threatened this school project because funding from the state that was going to set off a lot of the cost of the school project was in jeopardy. And the state said that the towns and the district had a certain amount of time to kind of deal with that lawsuit and get them an answer, a commitment that they were moving forward with the project. So there was a subcommittee formed. There's been a subcommittee working on this for a little while. And they're working on the underlying problem, which is the agreement, the regional agreement by which this school district operates. That's been the long-running contention on Yarmouth's part. They feel like the agreement has been unfair to them. Ironically enough, Yarmouth was the one who pushed back in, I think, 2006 to go in this direction with this particular agreement that's in place. So they kind of set the ball rolling there. But they've been paying more, primarily because they have more students in the school over that time. And so they've been having a difficult time shouldering that burden. And so they've been looking to adjust that. And this subcommittee that's been meeting appears to be coming to some agreement on how it might be possible to adjust the regional agreement and deal with this problem in a way that may essentially allow Yarmouth to withdraw its lawsuit and move forward with the regional middle school project that they were hoping to move forward with. Just in today's paper, however, there was an answer to the lawsuit by both Dennis and the school district where they essentially denied all the claims that Yarmouth was making. Dennis said, we shouldn't even be named in this lawsuit. We're not the ones who decided on the method by which the regional middle school vote was being taken, so we don't even know why you're naming us here. The school district has said this was the way that we went with that vote, and it was the proper way. There is some information that the state would support them in that contention, but obviously Yarmouth feels different. Yarmouth feels that this should have gone to town meeting. I think Dennis and the district also point out that Yarmouth knew this was the method that the mm-hmm. school district was going to use for this vote, should have acted before
from
the
last
vote.
June or July, they've known that was the method. And they didn't contest it until after the election when apparently they weren't happy with it.
Yeah, and obviously in the answer to this lawsuit, they're saying, why wouldn't you have fought it before the vote? Why did you wait until afterwards? So you kind of missed your chance there.
Another story we have in Washington, D.C., lawmakers have been discussing threats to the endangered North Atlantic right whale. And part of this has to do with a proposal to pursue exploration for offshore oil and gas.
Yeah, this was an interesting hearing held yesterday in D.C. It was the Subcommittee on Water, Oceans, and Wildlife. And during the hearing, one of the representatives from South Carolina actually used an air horn, and he said that was mimicking what the North Atlantic right whales may experience during seismic testing for oil and gas, which the Trump administration is considering off New England's coastline here. But it's really focused, again, on these permits that could be issued soon by the U.S. Department of Interior for five companies that are looking to do that exploration. And obviously opponents of that who are worried about the North Atlantic right whales and the population, which is critically endangered, say that testing could really cause a problem for these animals, which are really use vocalizations quite a bit to get around, to communicate with each other, and any loud noises such as seismic testing, they say, would have potentially affect that and harm the whales. The government does need some authorization to allow this activity to take place, and that's essentially what they're moving forward with. At the same time, yesterday there was a bill that was reintroduced, the Save Right Whales Act, and that's co-sponsored by including a couple of representatives from Massachusetts, including Bill Keating, who represents the Cape and Islands. And that bill would provide grants so that states, nonprofit groups, and members of the fishing and marine shipping industries could fund research and efforts to help the North Atlantic right whale population. That population, according to recent estimates, is down to as little as 411 animals. There have been some births this year that might bring that number up, but that's really a small amount. So a lot of these things are now happening in the halls of Congress in terms of trying to address this issue.
Patrick, Chatham residents and fishermen got a preview of a new study of their shifting coastline, and it wasn't great news, especially for commercial fishermen and waterfront homeowners.
Yes, and fishermen have been saying for quite a while now that they've been having more and more difficulty getting out through the inlets there from Chatham Harbor. In the past, there was the Chatham Bar, and they were able to go over that, a break that opened up, I believe, in 2007 to the north and essentially created North Beach Island, caused some problems in terms of the flow of water and sands in that area. And now these fishermen say that they are really kind of their timeline for getting out is tightening up, and they have more and more difficulty doing that. So this study is being undertaken. These are preliminary findings that came up in a meeting last week of this coastal resiliency and adaptive management study. They're really looking at what's happening, trying to get kind of information about what's happening, and then potentially figuring out how to use that to mitigate the problem. One of the things that became clear is this is, you know, just erosion that goes on over time, and a geologist who we often quote in our paper, Graham Geis, says this is a 150-year cycle, and the sand moves around. But some of these things really do cause problems in the short term for fishermen, and they're really worried about it. Homeowners are also worried about it, because when you eliminate parts of that barrier beach out there, it can cause major problems for erosion along the coastline for homeowners as well. So we'll see where Chatham goes with this, but they're at least gathering the information.
Your reporter, Jeff Spillane, has a story this week that got a lot of attention. It was picked up nationally. And Jeff, we know from his appearances here on the Roundup, is a dog lover. His story this week is on the rise of cases of dogs accidentally eating marijuana products.
Yeah, and this really did get a lot of attention. One thing that's important to point out is none of these veterinarians that we spoke to, and it was more than just kind of the example we used, which I think a lot of people focused on, of this woman whose dog ate some sort of marijuana product on the beach at Nauset and became ill and had to be taken to the vet. But we went, and Jeff went, and spoke to a lot of veterinarians, and a lot of veterinarians said that they were seeing this more and more, and it's happening across the country as marijuana is becoming legalized in a lot of states and maybe kind of around more households. They're finding that dogs are ingesting marijuana in different ways and becoming sick, and it can be problematic for the dog. And the important thing to remember here is a dog's often a much smaller body size than a human being, so if a human being eats some sort of cookie that has marijuana in it, and then a dog eats that same cookie, it's going to affect the dog quite differently and probably much more, according to these veterinarians. Can be fatal in the end, but in often cases it does just lead to these symptoms. Good to bring your dog into the vet. These vets were quick to point out that they're not, you know, being judgmental about somebody using pot or not. They're just suggesting, as with children, that you should make sure that your marijuana is safely stowed away so that your animal can't get to it. Anybody who has a dog who's a surfer of counters knows that they'll get into almost anything, and they just think that this was an important time to point out that you should be more careful with your products as you have them around the house.
One of these vets saying in the article, it's a rare day that we don't have one of these dogs hospitalized in the ICU there for ingesting marijuana products. So you can get a sense of how prevalent it is now.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's not as if we had one example here. We talked to a number of vets. Jeff talked to a number of vets who all said something similar. It's often that they see these dogs being brought in, and that's what you should do. You should bring your animal in. And they said, we don't care if you're smoking pot. We just want to make sure that your animal's okay.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you.
And we spoke with Sarah Mises-Tan from WCAI. We checked in with Landry Harlan at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, and spoke with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.